back, everybody, to the TV Talk Machine podcast. I am your co-host, Jason Snell, and across the internet from me, your host, chief TV critic at The Hollywood Reporter, Mr. Tim Goodman. Hi, Tim.
Hello, Jason.
Do you know your favorite TV show of the year is on right now, and it's the Warriors. It's moved to number one in the power rankings.
Yes, they should be at number one. They're 3-0.
They're unscripted, though. It's an unscripted series.
It's unscripted.
Is it conspiracy theories?
I almost never talk about them in public anymore. I don't want to jinx it. I talked a lot of super confidence in the 73 win season. And of course, we lost in the lost to the Bulls and now I'm running to the Cavs. And I was like, oh,
tis the season. I have friends who are hockey fans too. And it's just like there's playoffs everywhere. And I'm just a baseball guy where it's just like, whatever. There's a very slow paced game going on over here where people are throwing pitches.
Well, it was very funny that when they had the game on, the Warriors game on the other day, they said, because, you know, they locally here for you and I, they shift the channels and they said, if you're looking for the Giants, they're over on, we had to move them for this Warriors game.
Yep.
And they said, you could, Fitz, one of the local broadcast guys, had a kind of a cutting remark saying, game 18 of 162. So you could go watch that or the Warriors, right?
I thought you could watch, like, you watch somebody score 100 points or someone score one run.
Oh, my. And maddening, right? It's a struggle.
All right. Now that we scared away everybody with sports talk, we should probably talk about
it. Always up front.
Yeah.
We know if we load the sports talk up front, we'll cut back on the audience.
What are you doing? See, because there's Bill Walton. Anyway, we should talk about your reporter's notebook. High concept. I like the concept here. And the idea is the wonders of wabi-sabi. In other words, the Japanese concept of loving something. Is it because of its flaws or just finding beauty in a flawed, it's a flawed object, but you find beauty in it regardless.
Yes, absolutely. In fact, it's both. It's you know, finding beauty in it and then actually loving it for its imperfections.
Mm. I like it.
And that in some way, the imperfection makes it beautiful.
By the way, I can predict now that next week we will have a letter where somebody explains that this is actually not exactly what it means and that the Japanese concept is somewhat different or completely different. But
well, it's not completely different. It wouldn't surprise me if we had a letter saying that's not exactly true because I'm actually a huge fan of wabi-sabi and I know that there are lots of, I would say there's lots of interpretations about what it means exactly, but I would challenge almost anybody to say that I'm wrong the notion that it's finding something beautiful in imperfection.
You don't need to challenge the internet, Tim. You don't need to challenge them. They're going to do it anyway. But I like the idea. And you used Barry on HBO and Killing Eve on BBC America as two examples where neither of these is perfect shows. Can there be a perfect show? It's very hard that they have some big flaws, but your feeling is, you know what? That's okay. In fact, maybe that adds to the appeal that they're a little bit, the way I always think of it is sometimes a show is just kind of sloppy or it's ramshackle and it's kind of, it can be endearing in a way that it's like, it's just, you know, it's not quite on its axis. It's not a well-oiled machine, but you can view that sometimes as being a positive in the end, as strange as that sounds to say that a flaw is positive. It can be.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I love this band called Ockerville River, and they have a song that has a line that says, they're talking about movies. He's always talking about cinema and novels and poetry and such. But he had a line about a movie, and he said that it was reviled for its flaws, but its flaws are what made us have fun. And I think that's so true, right? A lot of times you go see a movie and it's like a critic will be like, this is once they do this. And then you get in there like that part, which is the flaw, becomes the part that has fun. But for me in this context with these two shows, I actually think in the end, these shows really do work. But at some point, and certainly Barry is the more extreme version of the wabi-sabi than Killing Eve. But even if you started with Killing Eve, which we should do here, you know, it's just when you look at it, it's like there was a fundamental someone in the room didn't say, Okay, so are we supposed to like the person chasing the assassin, and then we're supposed to like the assassin too? Like, we're supposed to like them both? But weirdly, it's almost like they tilted it in a way where the assassin, not played by Jodie Comer, is so exciting and so alluring in her own weirdness, her sociopathic bents, that Sandra Oh, who was ostensibly the more famous actress of the two, and probably the one that, you know, they're selling the international rights on. Sandra Oh's character is kind of a much more kind of not bumbling, but like she's just in a desk bound job at MI5 in England, which of course you have to explain that away. She's an American. She was born there. She comes back. She's American educated. She comes back. She gets a job as basically an agent for MI5, but she's desk bound. It's kind of boring. What she really wants to be is like a spy for MI6. And she has the insight on this case that is about this female assassin. And then she ends up getting put on this case and sort of tracks it. But there's an obvious flaw is that Sandra Oh's character is not a threat at all. She's not, like I said, not bumbling, but not really qualified, and never has been in a leadership position before. And the Jodie Comer's assassin, her name is Villanelle, she couldn't kill anybody. So it's not really a fair game. And then it diverges in the spy/agent genre mashup in that it's just kind of it becomes this gigantic mess. And you're like, I think that the assassin could kill her in any, like in a second, and in this whole show would be over, because she's so much more sophisticated with her killing. And Sandra Oh's kind of like, I don't know what I'm doing, and I just lost my luggage and all this stuff. That kind of like thing. She's very endearing in it, and she is very good. And as far as like a spy/agent thing, my review focused a lot about the fact that three women are involved. The two stars are women, and Phoebe Waller-Bridge wrote it, and she's a woman. That it had these excellent like gender flip elements where, you know, you do care more about their home life, but not in the traditional ways. There's a spin even on that. So that was really interesting. But it also made the show kind of something. Best I could say is something other. So it kind of doesn't work on like four or five different levels. And Sandra Oh's bumbling and comedic timing, you like her, and it's almost like, it's not like a rom-com, but it's light. And it's like, oh, this is kind of fun. Sandra Oh gets this dream job after getting fired, and she's going to have so much fun on this case. And the other half of the show is this completely sociopathic killer doing very, very violent hits. And it's really jarring. And you're like, oh man, the tone here is way, way off. And on Barry, I could say that it's that show times 100. Bill Hader's comic sensibilities in the first three or four episodes, it's so much a comedy. Especially when you have Henry Winkler. And then there's another character I talked about the character is so far over the top that it's almost a spoof of like a gay, like I think he's Croatian or something. And it's just so over the top and so hilariously a comedy. And it's a 30-minute show, and you'd think, oh, if this was just for laughs, it's pretty brilliant. It's pretty funny. Because Henry Winkler's great, Hader's great, this other actor's great. And then there's this shocking ultra violence to it because Bill Hader's character is an assassin who ends up going to Los Angeles to try to kill somebody and falling in love kind of with a person out there who wants to be an actor. And then he too is becoming an actor, and he's terrible at it, but it's like it gives him a purpose. It's a great concept. It's just, execution wise with these tonally clashing odds, it doesn't work. Like literally, Jason, it does not work at all for the first three or four. Like you're pulling your hair out, like be one or the other, because you're totally messing up what Fargo does great. You're messing up this ability to mash these two together. And then it just sort of by accident and sticking with it, it gets better and better. And then when it becomes very much a drama, the last three episodes of the eight, it's straight up a drama. The dramatic payoffs are much more intense because it came from a place of absurdist comedy, and that that route from A to B, which you would never think a show could get there or should even try to get there, it's just everything is so much more resonant because it started from this place that seemed insane at the beginning of the series, and now it's a straight on, nobody's making jokes per se, and it's a thriller and about an assassin who's getting cornered. And my notes for this show are like, what? Basically every note was like, what is happening? What are they doing? You know, and that's where the whole concept comes in of Wabi Sabi. When you sit down at the end, you think, oh my God, okay, both of these shows are so flawed in what they're trying to do. They went for something and they missed that mark by such a wide amount. They probably shouldn't even have started. And yet somewhere in the making of the series and stumbling to find a way, they created the best description is some other thing came from it. And that thing ends up being a pretty great show for both of them. And they're really compelling to watch. They're really fun. I maybe after I've said this, people won't be so shocked if they haven't seen them yet. But I would say if you hadn't heard me talk about this and you were watching it for the first time, you'd be thinking, okay, Killing Eve was kind of fun, but it's like all over the map. It's not making any sense, but I like these actors. I'll go with it. And then Barry is like, I don't know what they're doing with all that horrible violence because that's really funny. But as the shows go and they become different things, I think there's a real appreciation for them.
Do you think Barry, do you think they were going for the radical tone shift as a thing? Or do you think they just, because it does provide a pretty amazing contrast, right? Where you're like, oh, the show is like this. And then suddenly, oh, it's not like that. That can mm-hmm. be effective. Do you think that's purposeful? Or do you think they were really kind of like finding themselves and trying to figure out what the show was?
I'm sure that, I don't know what they would say. They haven't addressed it yet, but I think it's a happy accident. I definitely think that they were trying to, I think they actually had a concept on paper, Jason, that says Hitman, who's sort of dead-eyed and dead in his soul, comes back from Iraq. He's directionless. He gets kind of coerced into becoming an assassin, and he just is dead inside, and he has no motivation. Goes to L.A. To kill an actor and falls in love with Los Angeles and the acting community, especially certain wannabe actors. And I think that was funny on paper, and I think they were going to go for the comedy part of it. And I don't know if it was Hader wanting to do something more dramatic, like Bill Murray does dramatic stuff, because he just got tired of doing so much comedy. But I think that somebody, whether it was Hader or somebody else, said, you know what? I really like the dark parts of this. Let's make this darker. And because it's not evident at the front. It's violent at the front, but literally the last three of the eight episodes are a completely different show. And I think that's the show that they wanted primarily to get to. And it's really good when they're there. Like Barry could have worked as a drama with very limited comedy in it. Because then it would have just been a dark comedy. But I have to say that based on the fact that some of the early characters in the first few episodes are so insanely over the top, it's broadly sitcom based. So I have a hard time thinking that wasn't what they were actually going for. Because it just you wouldn't have cast one of the actors as this like nebulously gay, over the top, Baltic State hitman. It's such a spoof of a character if you really wanted to be serious. But where they get in their seriousness at the end is a completely different show, and it shouldn't work, but it really does. And I don't know where they're going to go from here.
That's the thing. It's coming back for another season. It got picked up for another season, which means there's this question of like, do they walk with their newfound tone, and go with that? Do they make another run at trying to mix them and end up with something that is again, kind of weird and different? It's a fascinating question of like, first off, what was purposeful and what sort of did they find, and what do they want a second season to be? Does it pick up where season one leaves off, or do they try to do another twist on it? It's a real question about how, what direction they want to take it.
Yeah. And I have to say that, there's, Killing Eve is a good example of Wabi Sabi on a kind of on a much more like an average, I mean, there is no such thing as an average wabi-sabi thing. It's definitely flawed, and it becomes something better because of its flaws. But Barry is, that is, to me, that's a picture postcard of, that's of exactly what that kind of, so kind of show would be. But I would say to anybody who's listening to this who hasn't seen Barry and is like, oh, well, they probably knew what they were doing when they got there. I would say that if you watch this show, there's a scene, there's numerous scenes that are, you're like, what, how, this is a totally different show. I mean, my notes are filled with triple underlined notes of like thinking, what is this?
A lot of question marks.
What are they doing? Yes. It was, I was befuddled, you know, but there is a scene where if you had any doubt that they really were going to lean into this stuff, there's a scene and things are already starting to get heavy, where Bill Hader's character is put into a situation where he has to, you know, consider killing someone who is a friend, and not just a friend, but a friend who's married and a friend who has a 5-year-old kid. And I don't think that anybody takes that kind of dramatic action unseriously. And, you know, when they make the decision and which way to go, it is an excellent piece of dramatic television. And there will be absolutely zero question that Bill Hader is all in on the dramatic side in that scene. And then you're convinced, like, okay, that's like, I had hints before, but when that scene came, I'm like, this show wants to be a drama, and this last half of the season is going all in for that show. So I wonder what they'll come back for in season two.
Very interesting. I think this is a fascinating observation that you're making here. I'm sure somebody out there is saying, Tim, did you just tell me that you need to stick with a show even though the first few episodes aren't very good? And that's the flip side of this is, you know, you could watch the first couple episodes of Barry and just say, this is not for me. I don't like this tone. And I guess what you're saying is, yeah, it shifts. If you're willing to make the investment, you will see the show kind of change. If you know, you have to go that way, though. You have to go through the beginning to get there.
And the weird part about it at the end, just to wrap up on this, I guess, but the weird part about the end, which really hits home for me on the whole concept of this wabi-sabi, is that I actually want the show as is now. I don't want it to come back as more dramatic next time. I want it to find this unpredictable balance and this totally ping-ponging between extremes, because I want to see Henry Winkler again. He is brilliant in this show. This is Winkler as good as he was in Arrested Development, if not maybe better. And he should have won an Emmy for his performances there. He's in more of the show in this one than he was in Arrested Development. And he is note perfect. And the broader the super ridiculous parts, that I could probably do a little bit without. But I don't want to lose the comedy part.
All right. Well, we'll see what they do. You want that mixture. You want that sweet and salty kind of combo.
Yeah,
I do. Strange combinations. It makes sense.
I do. Yeah. And in Killing Eve, you could have made the Comers, Jodie Comer's Villanelle assassin. You probably could have made her a little bit less magnetically interesting as a sociopath, and then the show would have been set up a little more traditionally, and I think it would have worked dramatically in a really interesting way, because Sandra Oh is such an interesting character, and the concept of her shifting from MI5 to MI6 and she's got a troubled marriage. You could have a lot of stuff to mine there, and you could have tamped down that Jodie Comer character a little bit, but by the fact that they really leaned into that character, which I think probably was a mistake, ended up being great, because I want to see more of her as well, because she's outstanding as this assassin.
You know, a villanelle is a kind of poem.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Or as They Might Be Giants taught us, don't hate the villain, hate the villanelle.
Right.
That's yes. actual mm-hmm. song. We should talk about second seasons. I know you and Dan have something in the works, one of these, you know, sending emails back and forth and turn it into an article kind of story is brilliant, genius. That's how articles get made. About second seasons, high-profile sophomore seasons, because there are a bunch out there right now. Obviously, Westworld comes back this weekend. Handmaid's Tale's coming back. Atlanta came back recently. The Crown, Legion, like all the way back to something like Stranger Things. So, you know, sophomore slump and how you fight it. What are you thinking about, you know, the, is it, you know, what's working or what isn't, or like, what's the problem with the sophomore slump and how can you overcome it? It's an interesting problem.
Yeah, it was an interesting thing to tackle. For me, it had to be a little bit more shaded because, I wrote about this just a couple of months ago. In March, I wrote about second seasons that were, how hard it is to launch a second season or get your second season noticed.
To get people to pay attention to it and with all the premieres.
Which is different, I think, because I think this was more like, is there a burden of expectations on truly successful first seasons, which is my column was not about. The original one was not about that. It was about, you know, how do you come back and get found again? So we ended up focusing a lot on, I think that Stranger Things is the series that is like the poster series for, I would have guessed that anybody who was analytical would have said, I don't think that's going to do as good in the second season. The ability to mess that up. I think that it was against all odds success story, which I think especially with new creators at the helm and a bunch of unproven kids, I think that the second season had disaster written all over it. And it turned out to be, I think, really fun and really great. And I was really stunned that they pulled it off. But, the two that we focused mostly on were two huge hits and two huge critically acclaimed series in Westworld and The Handmaid's Tale. And the way we fell, Jason, is that Dan is not a huge fan of Westworld. I am a huge fan of Westworld.
Yep.
And Dan is a huge fan of The Handmaid's Tale, and I am not a huge fan of Handmaid's Tale. And
boy, I am on the right podcast, aren't I? This is the one. I don't need to be on the one with Dan, that whatever that one is, or that imaginary one. That is, I'm with you. I'm Team Tim on this, I gotta say. But that's or maybe it's boring because we agree on this stuff. I don't know. But that's fascinating.
You actually had some really interesting insights. I would have, I think, gone that way anyway, but when you and I were in Vancouver and we were doing our podcast at the film festival, you were already way ahead of me on Handmaid's Tale. And
I think what I said was like, oh, Tim, oh, it's so bleak. Oh, it's like opening a vein I think I actually said it's like a punch in the face. And after a while, you're like, okay, I get it. It's a punch in the face. I don't want to be hit in the face anymore.
And I remember looking at you. We were having coffee in the morning. And I was like, wow, Jason, way to kill it. Because I think I told you, I said, I got five more episodes. And you were like, yeah, like just the weight of what I was about to experience. You're like, oh, good luck with that. And that really, I think it bore out. And then I was at Sadist, and I taught that class for my visual studies course at California College of the Arts.
Have fun, kids. Good luck.
Oh, and I'm sure they were like, what did you choose for us? This thing takes so long and it's so bleak. And, you know, it's funny because I found an appreciation for what it was trying to do in its small achievements and Elizabeth Moss' great performance.
Absolutely. I mean,
it's an anvil. There's no doubt about it.
It is so well made and it is well performed. It has important things to say. All of those things are true.
And when we got into this discussion, because we probably won't talk too much about this on the next podcast, and this thing will be out 4 or 5 days before our next podcast, I will say this, that like I went and I watched the first two episodes of Handmaid's Tale because I was not reviewing it. Dan was. It just like I reviewed second season of Westworld, and he had to play catch up and watch some episodes. And I watched the first two episodes of this season, and my initial reaction was, oh my God, like, because I thought we were making some forward momentum. If I don't know if you remember it, but basically episodes 8, 9, and 10 of last season were moving in a direction where you were like, okay, so the previous 7 hours of bleakness are in the books, and maybe we can have just a glimmer of brightness for Offred / June as she moves into maybe a new phase in her life. No. No. And I was just like, oh my, and to the point where I thought, okay, now they're purposely kind of trying to keep this thing going, installing. But I read Dan's review, and Dan, who loves the series, actually says, and he admits in his review, that I think he got 5 or 6 episodes from Hulu. And he says, yeah, there's really not a whole lot of movement as far as like, so it's like your nightmare and my nightmare come to fruition. It's like finding out that after 10 episodes, there's probably going to be at least 6 more where there's a lot of bleakness and not forward momentum. And I was like, okay, I'm out.
Yeah. I mean, it's if it's a show you can tolerate, like, and if it works for you and season one works for you, I guess that's the good news, right? Like, mm-hmm. It's not, if you didn't have a problem with season one, then you probably won't have a problem with season two. You're able to take that darkness, that bleakness in and, you know, just consume it or make it part of you or understand why it's there or however that is. And if you struggled with season one, I guess that's a good thing to know, right? Like it doesn't pick up, like the lightness doesn't come back into it or doesn't come into it at any point in season two either. So it's going to still be bleak and tough. And that's just what the show is.
Yes. And I openly wondered in my back and forth with Dan, whether contrary to maybe what you just said, is I wonder if there isn't a tolerance level problem. I mean, you and I hit it pretty early, I think, in first season. But other people who maybe loved it and thought it was great, I don't know, honestly, Jason, if they actually have a tolerance for the pacing issue that's at play in The Handmaid's Tale. Because there's one thing to do some world building, and sometimes that takes time, and I like attention to detail. I think they were definitely too slow in the first season. But not only does Dan say that it's who loves it, still says that they're really going nowhere. My perception of the first two were two things happened that I thought, like, the artifice on it was so high that it was implausible, and the series was just doing it for spectacle and for shock value, and they didn't need to do it. And then in the second episode, I tweeted this out today, they have a sex scene in the second episode of The Handmaid's Tale, which it's unbelievably out of character. And it happens, it follows a scene where the motivation to actually have sex after that scene is nil. And the fact that they go into this passionate sex scene, which is ridiculous, made me think that it was tone deaf. And I wonder if the absence of Reed Morano, the woman who won the Emmy for directing The Handmaid's Tale, you don't have a woman on the set as the director now. A man directed the first two that I saw. I don't think a woman shoots that scene. I honestly don't. I think a woman says, you know what, guys? She's not going to have sex after the scene that preceded this. Not happening. And I laughed through it because it was so absurd. And so if in the second season I'm laughing at a sex scene, and in the first season there's this big moment that I think is such artifice that was created by the writers to, I don't know, have some action and some like shock value for no reason, I think you got a real problem in season two. And I guess that's the reason we had this back and forth. Dan disagrees. He's all in. But I think I've seen enough where I don't think I'm going to want to go back to Handmaid's Tale.
Hmm. All right. Well, that's the, you know, and he doesn't have Westworld working for him. So I guess turnabout's fair play.
Yeah, he doesn't. And, you know, you and I talked about Westworld already, and I'm all in. And I think in its way, it builds new and exciting frontiers for the future, not only just because there's different parks, obviously there's Shogun World and all the stuff that's going to happen in the future. I'm excited as a fan of the show to go forward, and the forward momentum is not a problem in Westworld. I think he just doesn't like the fact that, as he said in our back and forth, if these characters don't have a whole lot of depth and to them, why he would care for them. But we just disagreed on that. But I guess that's why we have these things. That's why we do them.
Yeah, that's right. All right. Let's see what else you've got. Something coming up. I don't know if you want to talk about it now or if you want to just put it on hold until next week. about all of those shows that are being influenced by the era of Donald Trump.
Yeah, I think we will talk about that next week, because it might be interesting to sort of see what everybody's take is. The short take is, I 7 months ago I was excited for what might come out of Hollywood as a creative response to anti-Trump sentiment, and now I don't give a shit. So we can check the box.
There you go. All right.
We can check the box on that. But that's the short. And now nobody even needs to really read it right now. But basically, I said no one's listening to each other, and a show is not going to make that happen. It's not going to create a dialogue in our country to fix our divide.
That sounds about right. Well, we'll see what happens, how people react to it. I have a couple of things before we go to the letters. One is, we heard from many people, including listeners Andres, Craig, Betty, and Ibrahim, who said Just Watch at justwatch.com is the one to get if you're looking for an app or a website that will tell you where stuff is.
I absolutely 100% agree with them, because I took... Well, that's a lot of people who recommend it. Somebody recommended that, probably one of those people, on Twitter. Mm-hmm. And I had just happened to be on Twitter the other day posting something, and I saw that. And I wrote it down, and I made a look, and I made a point, and I looked. And I agree that Just Watch is really, really good. Somebody else recommended, after I posted that, replied saying, Go Watch It is also good. And I thought Go Watch It was actually pretty good, but I think Just Watch It is better. I think the search engine the user interface is easier, and there's fewer steps. And it basically, if all you want to know is like, where can I find the detectorists, you will know immediately.
Very good. So Just Watch, justwatch.com. It's got it for different countries and everything, which is nice.
Yes. And I would say to people that if you go to justwatch.com, that you can search for shows on their website. The flaw of the website is that they don't actually have a really clear button that says, hey, get our app. I looked around. I was like, oh, I guess they don't have an app. That's too bad. And so I bookmarked it on both of my laptop and my desktop. But today I found an app. They do have an app. They just didn't promote it very well on their site.
Yeah, they do. They totally do. You want to do some letters?
Yeah, let's do that.
All right, let's do it. Listener Atherin, originally from the 415, now in the 203, that's Southwest Connecticut, just sent in a link to a story about how Netflix is thinking about buying movie theaters, which is interesting because you see most movie theaters don't want to show Netflix movies because they don't want to compete with people watching them on their television. So Netflix is thinking they might actually buy some movie theaters, maybe just in New York and LA, where they would also be eligible for awards, of course, and screen Netflix movies in those theaters. Any thoughts about that? That's a funny, kind of interesting idea.
I love it. Right? I love it. I think that's a great workaround.
They got the money. And we know they're doing like practically a movie a week. So why not?
It's a great... I do worry about their money. Trust me, I do worry about their money. I think there was an Ad Age article recently that said they're overpaying people so much. They're looking for a movie publicist for $400,000. And I'm like, I will be a movie publicist for $400,000. I will quit my job as the chief TV critic at THR and be a movie publicist. I guess you'd have to be the main publicist to get that much money, but that is a shocking amount of money.
Yeah.
But yeah, I worry about their money, but that, I think that's a super smart play. Absolutely. You can... You know what? It would the only way to make that play a little bit better is if they went into LA and, you know, New York, maybe Chicago or whatever, and they bought some of the really classic old theaters that were being threatened to be torn down. And invested in those and kept some of the really great landmarks. I really love the landmarks in San Francisco and Oakland that are still up and showing movies. So the only way you could improve on that is rather than just buying like something in a mall or, you know, somewhere, you know, in Brooklyn or whatever, is to find like maybe like a newer cinema, to buy an older one, refurbish it, and then have your base of LA and New York screenings, and then you'd be eligible for Academy Awards. That is brilliant.
And 80, I think they said 80 films that they're releasing in a year. It's you could fill that movie theater, not a problem. That'd be very interesting.
Totally do it. Yeah. It's smart. It's a smart play.
Yeah. All right. So thanks to Athrun for setting that in. Dean in the 707 wrote in to say, "I took one for the team and watched the pilot of Netflix's Lost in Space." He said it's not good at all. Now, Dan reviewed it. He said it was okay. And I say, I have watched the first three or four episodes of it, and I think it's fine. I think not every show needs to be... First off, I like that it's a TV, like a PG show instead of an MA family show. I think that it's a family-friendly show. I think it is... I think it is not particularly cutting edge. I think it is a family drama mixed with some sci-fi adventure, which I think it's an absolutely appropriate way to describe it. And I'm okay with that. I think it's not like a lot of other Netflix programming and not like a lot of other sci-fi programming. And I'm okay with it. I think it's okay. I don't think it is one of the, I don't think it needs to crack the power rankings. Let's put it that way. But I actually think it's pretty well made and entertaining and has some, you know, good, a few good performances. Parker Posey is a lot of fun in it as the villain, basically, or
I heard she was
a mysterious character. You know, Dr. Smith is the bad guy sort of in the original. And, she's Dr. Smith sort of in this. You know, I like the application of kind of story logic and modern storytelling to a high concept like this, where instead of it being a sitcom set on a planet with, you know, a family and a robot, it's got all the pieces, but they try to put it inside a more kind of like cohesive, realistic setup in terms of the characters and also sort of in terms of the premise. And yeah, I think it's okay. So I got to disagree with Dean there. I don't think it is going to make anybody's list of brilliant. You know, it doesn't do. It's not The Expanse, right? Like The Expanse is trying really hard to be a really interesting modern take on a space show, and not Lost in Space is not, and that's okay.
That's and I really want to catch up on The Expanse. I have The Expanse, the new, catching up on season three, I guess. Is it started yet?
The first couple have already aired. Yeah
and I'm still way behind on season two. So I'm gonna catch up on The Expanse. I guess this would qualify as a slight Columbo, because I want to follow on your thing where you said not every show has to be, you know, this little sort of dark MA masterpiece. And I kept thinking about like shows that don't get the same notice and acclaim as sort of more of the highbrow shows. And even though this one is, I think, pretty close to an MA series, I have been very pleasantly surprised. Because I only had watched the pilot before, and I don't remember how many I watched, but I'm pleasantly surprised by how much I like The Punisher.
Oh, yeah. You know, I've only seen the first two of that, and I keep meaning to go back to it. But I, you know, for all the kind of, I've never really liked The Punisher as a concept in like the comics. He represents an era of comics that I didn't like. I think it was very, it's just, you know, anti-hero kind of thing that didn't appeal to me. And I thought after watching the first couple episodes of The Punisher, I was like, wow, this is actually a really compelling story. And that he was okay in Daredevil. But like a really compelling story about a broken person, like a post-traumatic people affected by post-traumatic stress. And like, it is it's got some violence and, you know, stuff in it, but it's also kind of sobering in its serious kind of portrayal of some psychological distress. And, I was surprised at that.
And I've gone through a number of episodes now and I'm like, huh, this actually gets better and better. I don't know if that's apropos of anything other than doesn't have to be like a marquee title, even though it's coming from a group that is definitely high profile. But maybe that's also just the latest Valentine to Peak TV, and that you can discover things whenever you want to and be pleasantly surprised when you stumble upon them.
I'm glad that there's a science fiction show on Netflix that is PG and has kids in a bunch of the major roles and is fun. And it's not, you know, it's not going to be, I don't think it's bad. I'm not saying, look, it's fun, even though it's junk. I don't think it's junk. I also don't think that they're trying to, you know, I don't necessarily think they have the highest of aspirations. I think they want to tell a fun story at this level where, you know, families can watch it and that the kids are involved in the storyline. And, you know, if for people for whom cute kids are anathema, don't watch Lost in Space, duh, because it's baked into the plot. Danger, danger, Will Robinson, danger.
Danger, Will Robinson.
Mm-hmm. All right, moving on. This is Matt from the 330.
Ooh.
He says, FX, with its extended length episodes of Trust, Legion, The Americans, and Atlanta almost every single week, is really challenging me. I've had to institute a rule. If I have to rewind three times because I've dozed off, it's time to call it quits for the night. Maybe I'm just tired lately, or maybe watching Russian spies make and discuss Zarkoya just isn't engaging me enough. It's coming to the point where I may have to drop Legion because I can't get through it all fast enough. It's an interesting show, but wow, is it weird? True. Especially when you keep falling asleep to it. Double true. Do either of you ever struggle to stay awake watching TV, even if you're enjoying it? Matt from the 330.
Well, I'm unclear on what he's complaining about. Is he complaining about running time?
I think he's saying that what happens is these shows often are running in a late time slot, and then they're an hour and 20 minutes long or something like that, or 40 minutes long. They're longer than he expects when he sits, even if he's DVRing them, they're longer than he expects going in. And so then he ends up, it gets later and later and later. And I felt this, where it's like, this is a show that starts at 9, but it turns out that it's an hour and 20 minutes long or something, or starts at 10 and it's an hour and 15 minutes long.
Yeah.
So I think that that's what he's going to, but he also wants to just kind of like you know, segue us over to like, do you have trouble? I get the impression that you do a lot of your TV viewing at like 1 a.m. Is that wrong?
Yeah, I do a lot of late night watching. Yes, I do, because, you know, I just found that like I have a, it's probably, it's difficult now because there should be more sun out, but if you were in California today and looked out, it's hard to watch television in the middle of the day
when it's
blue skies and it's warm. I have the luxury of my job where it's schedule-less to an extent.
Right.
So
you can be out where there are human beings out and about interacting with other human beings, and then go home, and at 1 a.m. or 11 p.m. or whatever, you can get in your TV viewing.
Yeah, it's kind of a great perk, depending how you use it. I am always appreciative of that, where I could, you know, I could spend the sunny daylight stuff out doing things that I want, whether that's errands or doing stuff with my kids or whatever. And so long as I watch my shows at night, and I'm a night owl anyway, so I tend to stay up. I've certainly been tired and had to like rewatch shows. I don't like to, if I'm falling asleep, I immediately turn things off because I want to make sure I comprehend what they're doing. But that said, I do not understand, and I know other critics, based on 2 years now of hearing them complain about it, I do not understand running time as a complaint about quality. So, like, from my point is, like, people, if you're just going to complain about the running time, and running time totals are your reason for complaining, that's an illegitimate critical complaint. If you're saying, on the other hand, that after the 60-minute mark, the content decreases and is not good enough,
or it's flat, or it's flabby because it should have been in 45 minutes and instead they took a whole hour, and it's, and the pacing is bad or something like that. That's the criticism, right? It's not the length fundamentally, it's what you do with it.
Right. And to me, it's like, but the way it's framed a lot of times is like, all these things that run long or extra, I'm so tired of that. Look, I'll watch 2 hours of a show if it's great.
Yeah, I don't mind 90 minutes of Legion. I do mind if I put it on and I think, okay, I've got just enough time to watch an hour long show before I have to go to sleep. And then I start watching it and I'm like, oh no, it's an hour and a half now. Like,
oh, it's funny,
I get that part.
Yeah, that's funny, because now what I do, anytime I put something in, As soon as it plays, I press pause
so
that my thing can tell me how long it is.
That's a pro tip. That's the thing for Matt to do if you're DVRing it or whatever. See how the length is before you make a decision to start watching.
Yeah, because a lot of times for me on screeners and links, they don't tell you how long. But I know that they do on streaming services, but not on our links for us. So as soon as it plays, as soon as it passed the credit, I press pause.
Like 2 hours.
I'm like, oh, no, I can't do that. But just to circle back quickly to my point, it's like, I don't think that's a really good critical thing, not from him, but from actual critics who are saying, I get it if you think that particular episode did not merit an hour and 12 minutes as opposed to an hour or 59 minutes. But if it's an hour and 12 minutes and it's really good hour and 12 minutes, I say do it again. And I'll judge the next one based on whether all the extra time you took was worth it. So the time in itself is not a thing, but if the quality is not there, I get it. It should be edited. But oftentimes I'm happy when I see something long if they can pull it off.
All right, let's move on. We've got we're moving into the wacky section of the podcast now. These are the wacky letters. All right. This is from Ninette in the 650, who writes, you referred to the Terror as Master and Commander on ice. Is it coming to a skating arena near me? I love that. Master and Commander on ice. Russell Crowe is Master and Commander on ice.
That'd be very funny.
Kelly in the 970 wrote in, this is a great, Kelly included a whole bunch of images too, which don't really translate to a podcast, of chest x-rays, real ones and ones in various TV shows. The point is, what Kelly's saying is, often TV shows will put a chest x-ray on a light board backward. So the heart is kind of pointing the wrong way, and that's amusing. But on Bosch on Amazon, they just did something I'd never seen before. They put the chest x-ray upside down. Classic Bosch, Kelly says. I love it.
Wow.
Upside down. That's not a thing.
That is tremendous. I love a not a thing about x-rays. That's cool. We haven't had a not a thing for a long time.
I know, right? Well, that is not a thing, the upside down chest x-ray. Those lungs don't go, don't point that way, dude.
Yeah, those are not lungs.
Isolate torso. Alice wrote in to say, Australia update.
Living
in the inner city Melbourne, safe from most deadly snakes and spiders. I used to laugh every time you guys talked about a new deadly Australian story. Until I went to first aid training for work today, and now I'm never leaving my house again. Here, meet a tiny jellyfish that can kill you within 20 minutes, but the symptoms can set in anywhere between 5 and 45 minutes after being stung. Not to be confused with the blue bottle jellyfish, which requires different treatment. Have fun in the water, everybody!
I am so never going to Australia. Like, I just, it's just not happening.
Dave from the 513 wrote in to say, after your show this week, I watched that video of the snake jumping between the trees that I mentioned last time. And he said, incredibly, the article described the snake as mildly venomous. I didn't realize venomous was an analog measurement. Word to your molters. Dave from the 513. Word to your molters. And that's it. That's the last letter.
That was so good.
Oh.
You know, you got to close on the word. Wow, I can't even say it now. Love to your molters.
Yeah, wow. Mildly venomous. It was a mildly venomous letter. If you would like to send us a letter about television or Australia, you can do so by emailing us podcast at tvtalkmachine.com or tweeting us, because Twitter lets you type like lots of words in Twitter now, at TVTM. And we will read those. And that's it for this week. But we did it. Somehow we did it. My internet came back. I was able to record a show. You came back. We had our moment. And then we'll be back next week. And people will have, in the intervening time, they'll corrected you on Wabi Sabi. They'll have thoughts about your thoughts about Trump TV. And who knows what else we might discover in the meantime. But until then, Tim, have a great weekend.
You have a great weekend too, and goodbye
everybody.
Have a fantastic week.